Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Matt Hamilton, Capital Bureau reporter and blogger on Capital Confidential for the Albany Times Union. Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Always great to see you here. You just broke a major story about the mainline Democrats and the Independent Conference of Democrats who broke away from the mainline Democrats to become basically, is this a bad word, handmaidens for the Republicans. Taking their money and getting a little extra money and behaving. But they're in a bad spot right now, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's a confusing situation to begin with, I think, for the outside observer who doesn't quite understand what on earth goes in the state Senate. I like to joke that it's like, whose line is it anyway? Everything's made up in Albany and the points don't matter. So we have a group of 8 Democratic senators who have broken away from the mainline Democrats. They are the Independent Democratic Conference, and they have a coalition, a power-sharing agreement with the Republican majority. On top of that,
which keeps them in power,
correct.
Keeps the Republicans in power with Democratic help, so the Republicans can help Donald Trump.
Well, so on top of all of that, we have an extra rogue Democrat, a 9th Senator Simca Felder of Brooklyn, who actually sits with the Republicans. So Simca Felder gives the Republicans the decisive 32nd vote that they need to control everything in the chamber. And then on top of that, they are bolstered by eight Independent Democratic Conference senators. That's 40 senators total that give them the cushion for their majority in order to put forward whatever legislation that the Republicans want. Now, the understanding is that the IDC has some say in what bills get to come to the floor. They have some committee leadership positions, but the knock on them from particularly the more progressive Democrats in New York is that they are not able to get major progressive victories, including, for example, the codification of Roe v. Wade into state law, the DREAM Act, JENDA, things that the IDC says that they are for, says that they support, put in their budget proposal, but to this point have not been passed by the state Senate at large.
That's so strange that the Republicans wouldn't codify Roe v. Wade in the state Senate. Look, these guys are, I don't know how to put it to you, Matt, but it seems to me there's things I can say that you can't, but that maybe, this is the world's oldest profession. For $20,000, they get named assistant chairman, which is probably in violation of the law, and get an extra $20,000, and they're willing to sell out their Democratic principles for that?
Well, and so this stipend controversy that you're mentioning is, it's really weird. I think, especially for a group, and I've said this before, a group of senators who is striving to be considered legitimate in the eyes of especially some progressive Democrats, it's another example of where things happen in Albany that all of a sudden when the public light gets shined on it, there's all this scrutiny, and it seems odd to some people. I mean, you have vice chairs of certain committees who have been getting paid the stipend, the committee leadership, the chairman's stipend for their work on these committees. Now, in state law, there are specific stipends lined out for the chair. It says, chair of the finance committee,
right.
You get this stipend, not chair of the vice chair of the finance committee, you get this stipend. However, and this is, by the way, 3 IDC senators and 4 Republican senators who have received these stipends, even though they are the vice chairs. However, there's an ongoing legal dispute, and I don't have the law degree to be able to say which side is right or wrong, but there's an ongoing legal dispute over whether the Senate Republicans have the authority to run their house the way that they see fit. That's what the Republicans say. We have case law to back up that we are allowed to hand out stipends as we see fit
because we are
the majority. Yeah. But the Democrats say this is specifically outlined in state law.
Exactly.
Right. So
the Democrats are right. The Republicans are wrong.
And so now we get into a whole nother area where, payroll has to be approved by the state comptroller's office. Where does the state comptroller come into this? And the state comptroller's office says that it's up to the Senate to determine which employees are entitled to which pay. We simply have an administrative role in approving these documents. So it's
a mess.
Difficult. It is a mess. And I think the broader political implication to all of this is it is difficult to, I think, describe to the average person who does not have 15 minutes to sit down and listen to me explain to them what on earth is exactly going on in the state Senate and how it affects them specifically. So we are talking about this in 2017. We're not even halfway through 2017. The 2018 election is a long time from now, and there's a lot more things that can happen. And so while there is a lot of scrutiny on this right now, and even once you start explaining it to people and they start to understand it, perhaps they would become upset and you know want to do something at the ballot box about this. We have a long time for this story to be sustained, for the need to sustain the story for a long time, for it actually to impact the vote in November 2018.
But Matt Hamilton, I don't understand something, really. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand something. I'm watching this all this time. I'm old now and thinking about all this stuff. But how can Jeff Klein, the leader of this group, of the independent, so-called independent Democrats, world's oldest profession group, how can Jeff Klein, a Democrat from the Bronx, a real Democrat, argue that he is keeping the Republicans in power? I don't get that.
There are a lot of people who also don't get that. You're not the only one by any means, Alan. I mean, their argument is that we have a bipartisan government. We are making government work. Now, at the end of the day, for example, are bills like the codification of Roe v. Wade not coming up? No,
they're making government not work.
But the argument that they make is that they are able to advance some legislation that would not otherwise be advanced if they were in the Democratic minority. These bills would not be allowed to come to the floor because they wouldn't have the power. But with a power sharing agreement, they're able to get, you know, and forgive me, I'm having trouble thinking of one off the top of my head, but you know, even smaller legislation that impacts people's lives, they're able to get that to the floor at the end of the day because they are IDC members and they do have a majority coalition.
Well, so now we have a special election for a senator.
Yes.
And the Democrats win that one.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that change the control of the Senate?
Well, so far it hasn't changed and it doesn't appear that it's going to change, but we now have 32 registered Democrats again, keeping in mind, of course, that 8 of them are in the Independent Democratic Conference. And
world's
one of them,
profession, yeah.
One of them is sitting with the Republicans, had both the Democratic and the Republican line in last year's Senate race in Brooklyn, Simca Felder. So just because we have 32 elected registered Democrats does not mean that the Democrats are going to control power anytime soon necessarily, because there are a lot of personalities and politics behind the scenes that keep these people from not coalescing and keep them from not being together and working as a unified Democratic majority.
Now, Matt Hamilton, some people think that there's some racism involved in all of this, that in fact the regular Democrats are controlled and have a lot of people who are committee chairmen or who are leaders who are of color, and that these basically white guys who became the Independent Democratic Conference couldn't stand that.
No, I don't subscribe to that notion. I don't think that's accurate. And also, the Independent Democrats have Marisol Alcantara, a woman of color from Manhattan. They have Jesse Hamilton, a man of color from Brooklyn, and Jose Peralta, a man of color from Queens. I don't subscribe to that notion.
Okay, well, we'll move on. Okay. I have some differences with you on that one, but let's move on from that to this guy you mentioned, Simca Felder. Now, this is getting more and more wild. Felder runs, always has run on the Democratic ticket. Now he runs on the Republican and Democratic ticket, but conferences with the Republicans, even though he runs primarily as a Democrat. Now, and everybody said, well, you know, that's Felder, that's who he is, this is what he's doing. But now he writes a letter, which has been widely reported in the press, urging the 8 traitors, so-called traitors, to get back where they belong with the regular Democrats. What's that about?
So I mean, it's Simkefelder, as he put it to a couple people yesterday, calling Jeff Klein's blush, or bluff, excuse
or
me.
Or blush.
Klein and the IDC put out this unity pledge earlier this week, calling on all Democrats to sign a pledge in support of various progressive agenda items. Now, we can discuss what the exact significance that has when all these Democrats are not forming a majority to actually push these bills. However, I digress. So Simkefelder says, okay, you want me to sign a pledge? Well, why don't you sign a pledge to work with the mainline Democrats?
Uh-huh.
And the question then is, well, does that mean Simkefelder would work with the mainline Democrats? And Simka says, well, you go back first and then I'll answer your question. But what we know of Simkefelder is that he is somebody who is in it for his constituents, or you know, that's how he describes it. He says it does not. It does not.
That's what they all say.
But to him, it does not matter who he sits with, who is empowered, as long as at the end of the day he gets the best possible deal for his constituents in his district. And so that's why he stayed with the Republicans. He says they help me best serve my area of Brooklyn. And so he has said, if the Democrats were able to help me best serve my area of Brooklyn, you know, I'll consider it. I'll talk about it. I'll do it. But right now, he's not. He's obviously not doing it. He's staying with the Republicans, and we continue to be in the predicament that we're in.
Okay, let's move on to the governor, who has now put out a letter to the Republican Trump, saying that he needs the federal government to help figure out and fund transportation alternatives while repair work is undertaken after a spate of problems, including two derailments. Okay, let me change the question to this. You got an MTA, Metropolitan Transportation Authority. It is run, frankly, the governor has the votes. Now, the governor and the mayor of New York are in a death spiral battle with their arms around each other's throats. The subway riders in New York are not a happy bunch. And the governor has more votes on that MTA than anybody else does, which means, knowing this governor, he'll do what he wants to do and tell him what to do. And people are holding him responsible. So now he tries to lay some of that off on the president, saying, you got to give us some money for this.
Right. So to your first point, the governor went on the radio earlier this week and said, I have 6 of 14 votes. I technically don't have control. However, I am not shirking my responsibility for the bad when the good when I take credit for the good, I'm also not shirking my responsibility for the bad. Yeah. So calling on the president to do something is interesting, just given kind of this ongoing narrative that some people in Albany have written about, where the governor is critical of ultra conservatives in Washington, specifically in the Congress, Republicans. But he's been sort of careful about criticizing Donald Trump by name, obviously, because he has to govern and needs a federal partner at times, as we see here. He's looking for the federal government's help in at least taking Amtrak away, or taking Penn Station away from Amtrak in some form or fashion, whether that's state control or another entity's control. But I think, to the larger point, and granted, I'm someone who lives in Albany. I take the subway when I visit New York, but I don't live there on a regular basis. I don't deal with these problems. The governor makes a point that for decades, the system, the subway system specifically, was neglected. The money was not put in there by the people who were in charge. Nobody wanted to pay attention to it. And now we are seeing the effects of decades of neglect. And I mean, just my observance of public policy as a Capitol reporter would lead me to believe that, yeah, if you don't invest in something over decades and it starts to deteriorate, all of a sudden, when you start to try to make the system better and it consistently doesn't get better, I mean, that stands to reason to me. And we see a system that has increasing ridership, the highest ridership level ever, you know, crowded trains, and then on top of that, serious infrastructure problems, just getting the trains to run on time. And so it's a bit of an impossible situation, probably, where the governor's been in power for 7 years, certainly enough time to start doing things. And he has. He's done the Second Avenue subway line. He's done, excuse me, other infrastructure projects.
Yeah,
and he started doing things. But is it enough to undo decades of of mismanagement of the system. I don't have the answer to that.
Well, Matt Hamilton, his critics claim that as soon as the Second Avenue stations opened for the first time, mm-hmm. he was the first guy out there thumping his chest and saying, "This basically is mine because I have the MTA working with me." Now, when the mud hits the fan, he turns around and says, "No, that's just the MTA. That's not me." There seems to be some hypocrisy there.
Perhaps to a degree, but it's again he did come out and say, "I'm not shirking responsibility for bad things that happened to the system as well." It's a tough spot to be in, and again, I think the question that I come back to just more broadly is how much can at the end of the day, and again, I don't have the answer. How much at the end of the day can one person do to completely turn around a system that is struggling? And I don't know. There's a lot there, and it's a system that moves millions upon millions of people every year. What do you do? I don't have a public planning degree to be able to tell you.
On another subject, moving along, Matt Hamilton, the governor now faces a draconian budget from Washington. Yeah. We don't think that this is the budget we're going to be seeing coming out of the House and the Senate, because people have to get reelected. But it is the art of the deal. In other words, he takes away a lot, and then he says, "Okay, give me something back," you know, this kind of thing. Be less draconian. But the governor now turns around and says that what this budget proposed by Trump is the Niagara Falls of trickle-down mm-hmm. economics. Now, this governor may have some trouble. There's about to be a major trial with some of his best friends who are accused of having ripped off the system. The subways and the strap hangers seem to be giving Mayor de Blasio a tough time. They're giving the governor
yes.
a hard time. So he's got some problems mounting up. But Trump is a New Yorker. Is there any sense that he has any loyalty to the city at all?
New York is not who elected Donald Trump.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the map of the state, people will argue that look at all the red counties. I mean, at the end of the day, the Electoral College votes went to Hillary Clinton because the major centers of population in the state voted for Hillary Clinton. And so if there's any interest in Donald Trump at getting back at New York, which I don't know if there is, it probably isn't, but who knows? This state did not vote for him. He did not get elected by the people of the state. His voter base is in the South and the Midwest and you know, rural middle America. And so this budget would, I guess, be more geared toward helping those people. Now, we've seen stories where especially his proposed cuts to programs for the poor, like food stamps, other things like that, would hurt specifically poorer Americans who were looking for change in the last election, looking for something different, and voted for Donald Trump. Whether he has any loyalty to New York, I mean, he does have an entire country to think about. And so if the state of New York cries about, for example, Medicaid cuts, and what would that do? What would that do to the state budget? I mean, Donald Trump has 49 other states to think about in crafting a federal budget. So
You think he's more sanguine about California or Massachusetts, you know, the other blue states you say he has all these other states to worry about. Only got a few states to worry about because that's his base.
Well, yes. But yeah, I mean, his base is in, again, but it's again in those Midwest and Southern states. And I guess personally, I don't have the depth of knowledge to know what, for example, the Trump budget's effects on Mississippi are. But Donald Trump certainly, he knows New York. Whether he's thinking about New York or not is unclear, but he knows New York. He knows the problems here. But again, there are Republicans in Washington who represent New York specifically. I mean, take John Faso, someone who has proposed and got into the American Healthcare Act that passed legislative language that would require that New York State and New York State only assume the county share of Medicaid costs, something that state officials went completely berserk over. and said you were going to harm all New Yorkers, you were going to bust the budget. But this is John Faso, who represents in Congress a specific district in New York, in the Hudson Valley, in the Capital Region, saying, no, this will help people at the end of the day. You will be able to lower local property taxes by shifting this. And so I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that while the Trump budget may be harmful to New York, Trump or so specifically New York Democrats say, Trump is not the only Republican that is doing things that he thinks would be best for the nation and, you know, the states and what have you. There are other Republicans, even those who represent New York, who are doing things at the end of the day that they believe will be helpful. But there is a lot of uproar from people who think they will be harmful.
So, Matt Hamilton, I wanted to ask you this. You had Faso, Congressman Faso, I've known him for many, many years, who voted for the president's health care bill. You had Elise Stefanik, who did the same thing up in the North Country of New York. Both are getting tons of problems as a result of that vote. Do you think either of them could be defeated as a result of their votes?
At the end of the day, when we think about political races, we always come back to what? The kitchen table issues, right? Jobs, taxes, the economy. You know, do I have a job at the end of the day? Am I able to afford to put food in the food on the table for my family? The point has been made by some people, and I agree with it, that healthcare could be considered a kitchen table issue. If you have health insurance one day and 3 months later you don't have health insurance anymore, that is a huge impact on your life. I think that we have to be careful about one vote in May of 2017 saying that that is going to be the one issue that completely changes the tide of an election. There are a lot of things that can happen between now and then. Let's see what happens with the budget. Let's see what happens with the Trump tax plan. But I think this uproar that you're seeing, if it can be sustained and if it morphs into other issues, that does most certainly create problems. Create problems in those districts, and that would embolden Democratic challengers. I mean, we've seen 5 people are already filed with the Federal Election Commission to challenge John Faso in 2018. I mean, it's and some of them are saying it's because of votes that John Faso took in Congress. Some are saying that we saw what happened with Donald Trump and we can't ever let this happen again, and we need people who are going to stand up and oppose the president, not go along with him. But again, I think the broader point is that healthcare is a big deal. It could be a major issue in the next election. It likely will be a major issue in the next election. But let's also see what else happens between now and the next election to sway voters into voting one way or the other.
We only have 2 minutes and 57 seconds to go. I wanted to ask you really quickly, Matt Hamilton, about the push for a constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm so old that I've sat through before. What happens is the political apparatus gets a hold of it. They elect the same friends of, you know, so I've never been a big fan of spending millions and millions of dollars on yet another charade, just like we have in the legislature. They want to change the Constitution, let them use the legislature to do it. My friend Jerry Benjamin and others are really for a constitutional convention, thinking it offers all kinds of hope for political reform. What say you?
Well, I, as someone who's never seen the Constitutional Convention process before, I think it's exciting on some levels, just to as a political thought experiment to think about it. And also, we are a state. New York does not have referendum, so maybe we should have a constitutional convention to give us the power to have referendum.
Which is probably, Matt, why the legislative leaders, it's a good tip off, don't want a constitutional convention.
Right. To this point, people have generally been, the public at large is generally supportive when you ask them about the general question, would you be supportive of a constitutional convention? People generally support it. However, we have not seen the influx of money specifically from unions who are more often than not against a constitutional convention because they're wary of what perhaps anti-union things could be put into the Constitution. We have not seen the money poured into anti-con campaigns yet. That will come later this year, probably September, October, November, when we get closer to the vote. So we'll see just how much the public perception changes. But yeah, again, personally, I think it's a fascinating thought experiment at the very least. And to be able to watch it play out, I mean, just being selfish, it's something that I think would be fun to report on.
Yeah, sure. But you're young and I'm old. And I've been around and I've watched them pull this garbage before.
Sure.
And not a lot comes out of them, and you spend a lot of money on them. But anyway, our guest has been a very articulate young man, Matt Hamilton of the Albany Times Union. He's a Capitol Bureau reporter, and he knows his stuff, as you can hear and as you've heard today. Thank you, Matt, for coming in.
Thanks, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.